WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are into the spring, and I put the darkness up behind me here. Sometimes I bring in the dark clouds of crime, and we try to do Baltimore Positive around here, but from the very, very beginning, we said we were going to be talking about the tough issues. All of our Baltimore Positive stuff brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets, and we're having some wise conversations around here, and this will be one of them, as well as our friends at Fadley's. We're going to be shipping those crab cakes all over the world all summer long and eating them because they're delicious, as well as the mac and cheese, and they're coming to Catonsville soon. And our friends at State Fair are already at Catonsville, and we're looking to get back there. I think next month we're going to get back, and Don Mueller is going to be French pressing coffee in the mornings. Don, we have a, 2.5 years ago, I said, let's start Baltimore Positive. We'll do this. This guy here has run for mayor, and we've gotten to know him over the course of time. And I think when things come up in the issues of crime and prosecution in Baltimore, we reach back to Thiru Vignaraja. Don, I know, we're always bringing people back, but the recurring themes, we're collecting people along the way.
This one of our favorite guests, and want to thank also our sponsors at Mueller and Gary Realty. I know Jeff Mueller is eager to get down there and take a look at that condo.
Buy my place. Here's the view. Thoreau, you want it? Come on down
again. There you go. Jeff said give him a call and at MuellerandGary.com and he'll get that taken care of. But truly, former deputy attorney general, former very active mayoral candidate, one of our favorite guests on Baltimore Positive, Thiru Vignaraja. Thiru, welcome back.
Good to see both of you. Good to hear your voices, gentlemen. It is always a fun conversation. And whether we're talking about hard challenges or some of the bright spots, it is a very, very positive conversation. So very much in the spirit of what you guys set forth to do a couple years ago.
Well, this time last year, we saw your billboards were up everywhere, right? And you're running and like all of that. You ran on murder and crime, right? Like on ending it, making it less, under 200. You had all sorts of pronouncements, right?
Yeah.
Where are we a year later? I mean, certainly pandemic was something we talked about a little bit, going into the election last year, but there was no sign that it was going to recede. We're now getting to the point where I'm getting my shot tomorrow, by the way. Mueller's all fixed up. He's running around the world. But I get mine tomorrow. Where are you on this murder statistic that continues to come out every night? And knowing that many of these murders are gang related, retribution related, but give us an update. And for our audience that hasn't heard you speak before.
Yeah.
Look. Nestor, let me just throw before you jump in. I want to build on Nestor's point, cause I think it's so important that he mentioned we keep talking about the same things. It's Baltimore Positive, but it's depressing. Nestor and I talk about these same themes, and just recently we had a weekend where 10 people were murdered, 14 others were shot. That's 24 shootings that we know of in our great city. So now that with that context, it leads to Nestor's question: the heck's going on?
So let's take a step back, because there was some cause for optimism. The longest period that Baltimore's ever gone without a homicide was during Snowmageddon a couple years ago. And so we always believe that if people are not outside, that it is harder to find your targets. The drug markets are a little less profitable. And as a consequence, the pressure to, hold and control this drug territory is a little bit less acute. So there's always this hope that the one silver lining of this terrible, tragic pandemic might be a decline in violent crime, in shootings and homicides. And unfortunately, at the tail end of the campaign, we saw the early signals that that was not to be, that the relentless pace of murders in the last few years would continue. And we are, just at a slightly worse clip today than we were last year and the year before, which are two of the most violent years in Baltimore history. It is. It's hard to stay optimistic. You, I think, both know, your audience may know, that I spent my career as a prosecutor, as a federal and city prosecutor before I was deputy attorney general. And it's certainly not the only issue that we face. It's certainly not the only issue I spoke about when I was running for mayor, but it is the front and center challenge. It is really hard to talk about the Orioles or Cedric Mullins on the light side, or about turning around your schools or fixing your potholes when somebody's getting shot and killed every day. And I would remind folks that there was a period, it wasn't that long ago, this was not ancient history, where murders were going down, shootings were going down. And relevant to some of the conversations we're having around Baltimore today, arrests were going down too. We're not talking about the 100,000 plus arrests of the Martin O'Malley days or the 80,000 arrests of the Sheila Dixon days. We were down to, you know, 40,000, 35,000, 30,000 arrests, and yet shootings and homicides were going down. So the sort of fiction that you have to arrest more people to bring violent crime down, that's not consistent with the bright patches in our recent history, where we saw a decline in violent crime, and frankly, we saw a more progressive approach to criminal justice.
Well, Theroux, in the midst of all of this, and you know, I can see it, you know, Nestor lives right downtown. So everybody knows there's, you can see it behind him. That's the view out his window. And, you know, I see it in his face every time we talk about this, because it's painful. And then in the midst of this, I read our good buddy Dan Roderick's article recently, and he talks about a conversation that he had with you. And I'm thinking, if it isn't complicated enough, now you tell us we can't even count. We can't even get the number of clearances correct. And that was a fascinating article. And I need you to walk our audience through what I mean when I say, you tell us we don't even know how to count.
Yeah, look, and this is important for a very simple reason, which is you've got to know what you're good at and what you're bad at. And if you are not arresting people for murders that are happening in your city, that's a problem. Everybody knows that, right? You don't have to go to law school. You don't have to be a prosecutor to know that if people are committing murders and are not being arrested for it, that's a big problem. It sends the wrong signal.
It's getting away with murder, literally, right?
Literally, exactly. And just sort of do a comparison. You know, Don, in Baltimore County, you have about a dozen detectives, homicide detectives, for on average 30 to 35 homicides each year. One homicide detective for every three murders. Even in a bad year, when it spikes to, you know, 40s, you know, low 50s, you're still talking about one to four detectives to homicides. In Baltimore City, we have about 40 to 45 homicides detectives. We have 335 homicides last year. You're talking about one detective to eight homicides. Now, if you don't think that bears on the ability of detectives to clear cases, you don't know how these cases are work. They take time, they take energy, they take resources, they take detectives to stay focused on these cases. And the numbers that you were just alluding to tell the full story.
Well, Theroux, while you're talking about that, and I want you to get back to the numbers, but people may not be familiar with one scenario. Nestor is, I'm confident you are. But years ago, there was a former police chief who decided, for whatever reason, that he was going to come in and just rotate people to different positions. So Baltimore City at that time had a group of really top-notch homicide detectives. Gary Childs, for example, who we know through his exemplary work in trying to look into the Sean Souter death, I mean, and others. And these guys were top-notch across the nation. And because of that decision, they said, I'm not going back out and walk the beat. I'm a homicide. And several of them came to Baltimore County and strengthened what was already an incredibly strong homicide decision. So the cream of the crop, because of that decision, left the city. And I've always said, I'm not sure they ever fully recovered from that.
Yeah, my friend, Detective Brian Wolf. A lot of folks know now about Detective Brian Wolf because of Wolf Security, the private security. But before he was sort of well known for that, he was a homicide detective in Baltimore County. And we had a witness murder case. I was a city prosecutor. It was a witness in a city case, but the witness was killed in Baltimore County in Woodlawn, where I grew up. And I worked that case with county detectives. We prosecuted it in Baltimore County. And I worked with Detective Wolf. They worked on that case tirelessly for months. It was one of a small handful of cases that he and his partner could work on every day, every week for months. And that was a witness murder, but they treat every case that way. So what happens is they solve 90 to 95% of their cases by virtue of an arrest. In Baltimore City, over the last few years, that number is closer to 20%. Now, the reason that's complicated, what you're referring to, Don, to sort of get into the nuts and bolts, is that's not the number you'll hear from the police department. It's not the number you'll hear from the state's attorney. It's not the number you'll hear from the mayor. They will tell you that the clearance rate for Baltimore City is closer to 40%. Now, be clear, 40% is nothing to be positive about. That's still a bad number. Only 40% of murders being cleared is not something to be crowing about. But that number includes two things. It includes cases that you're solving from previous years, which is okay, but it does mean that you're not really talking about that particular year. And it includes something called exceptional clearances. So if I'm a suspect in somebody's murder, and then I myself am killed, that murder that I was the suspect in is considered solved. It's considered clear. And I get that from an internal allocation of resources. The detectives don't need to work that case anymore if the suspect has been killed. Detective Wolf can focus on another case. But it does, when you're talking to the public, send a little bit of a mixed signal that your clearance rate is 40% when actually half of those cases were exceptional clearances or cases from the previous year. So we looked at the
Hold on for a second. Two things.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we get into the weeds on the show, and I know folks are saying, wait a minute, that went too fast.
Yeah.
Number one, talk about the concept to our audience of exceptional clearances, because I want to, once you do that, before you go on to the numbers, I want to talk about the one exceptional clearance example that you gave, which is where the prime suspect was shot and killed him or herself. But talk to folks about what that means.
Let's do some simple numbers. In a particular year, imagine if we only had 10 homicides, okay? Five of them get solved by an arrest. You find out who the person is, you build a case, you arrest those five people. Now you've solved 50% of the cases. Now what happens when in three additional cases, you've got a suspect, but one of those suspects is killed by another gang? One of those other suspects is put in prison on drug charges for 50 years, and one of those suspects has a heart attack and dies. Well, those three cases, for each of those reasons, doesn't have to be worked anymore, right? One of them's in federal prison for 50 years, one of them has been killed by a rival gang, and one of them had a heart attack. So for the purposes of the police department, those three cases don't need to be worked anymore. But if you tell the public that your clearance rate is now 80%, that 8 out of 10 of the cases have now been solved, the public is like, that's pretty good. 80%, that's a solid solve rate, when actually you only solved 50% of the cases. The other three were not because of good police work in particular. It's because a rival gang got to him first. It's because the feds got to him on different charges first. It's because a heart condition got to him first. That is not a measure of how well your police department is doing. It's not a measure of how good your prosecutors are. So, in Baltimore City, 2017, 18, and 19, there were 1,001 homicides in those 3 years. Of those 1,001 homicides, only 244 of them resulted in an arrest. Put aside prosecution, conviction, sentencing, only 24% of them resulted even in an arrest. And that number is not getting better, it's going lower. And so one of the frustrations for me is when I hear that we need to focus more resources on violent crimes. Who disagrees with that? Everybody agrees we have to focus more resources on violent crime, carjackings, robberies, shootings, killings. That is not translating into more detectives, more experienced detectives, more resources focused on homicides.
Well, certainly not more cops on the street right now, right? I mean, you know, that we've talked to everybody about that, and that's where the FOP –
yeah.
As much as a lot of times they don't make sense, that's when it makes sense to me. You know, when the FOP's yelling, like, we used to have X amount of officers, we now have M amount of officers. Literally, it's not X and Y. It's significant how fewer officers, right, Theroux?
Yeah, it is. And you know, during the campaign, I would repeatedly say the police department is likely down 500 to 600 police officers. That is a significant deficit. And it's relevant for two things. And when people talk about community policing, Every Democrat I know, myself included, says community policing has got to be the backbone of how we go forward. And what that means is having cops in the community, getting to know their beat, getting to know neighbors and family members, getting to get the intelligence from those communities. Well, that requires cops. That requires cops to be able to be out there. So if you're down 500, 600 police officers, you can't have that community policing. And it means you don't have enough detectives to work the violent cases. So if you have a shortage of officers, two critical functions that we all believe in, that cops need to be out there getting to know their community and detectives need to be out there working violent crime cases, both of those things are at a shortfall. And Baltimore County, 1 to 3 homicide detectives to homicides versus Baltimore City, 1 detective for every 8 homicides. That's a simple measure of why we don't have enough cops. And if there's one bright spot over the last couple of months, Mayor Scott and I disagreed on some number of matters. We're all rooting for him. We need him to succeed. I know that people think he was going to come in and abolish the police department or defund the police. The budget shows that actually the police department budget is going up. I don't think there's as much a distance between Brandon Scott's administration and what a lot of us on the campaign trail said. You know, Sheila Dixon and TJ Smith and I all agreed that you couldn't, you know, defund the police in the middle of a crisis. And it looks like Brandon is appreciating the reality of that as well. And I think that's actually a positive development. Some of his biggest, most ardent supporters are frustrated that the police budget is actually bigger this year than it was last year. But I think he's waking up to that reality with the mantle of responsibility of being mayor. And I think that's a good thing.
I think there's no doubt. And we've talked to the mayor a number of times. I don't think anyone is more frustrated, has lived it, has walked in those shoes than Brandon Scott. I mean, I think when we have a weekend like we did, I mean, I've gotten to know the mayor, Nestor's gotten to know the mayor. There's no doubt in my mind that he was sickened throughout that weekend when his phone kept ringing 24 times. And you make the Baltimore County comparison through, and I'll knock on wood publicly right now, that it's not a fair comparison. And I used to say, it's fair in terms of the numbers that you present, but I always say in terms of the challenges, and Johnny would be the first one to say so, is that, as you said, an outlier year in Baltimore County, you might hit 40 and people would be alarmed. But in a typical year in Baltimore County, if somewhere between 25 and 35 homicides. And I used to point out to folks that in the bulk of those homicides in Baltimore County, they are many domestics and where the individuals knew one another. So, for example, Baltimore County had a fairly violent couple of days recently. And again, as they do it, it's like, oh, what's happening? And I said to folks, wait, take a look at them. One was a son who shot his mother and father. Another was a wife. I mean, I said they were not crimes. They were not random crimes. And what I think is so frustrating, and again, where we want you to, I guess this segues into our next topic.
John, let me interrupt you.
Go ahead, please.
I think this is an important clarification, because I had this conversation recently with former police chief Jim Johnson, who I know you know well. It is absolutely true that some proportion of the murders are domestic violence cases, which of course are easier to identify the suspect and build a case against. But if you take those out, Jim Johnson will be first to tell you that the proportion of cases is roughly the same. A lot of the homicides in Baltimore County are drug and gang related too. They're in Woodlawn and Randallstown. I mean, they're sort of just, frankly, spillover homicides.
And we still solve those, is what you're
correct.
Suggesting.
Exactly.
No doubt about it. Regularly, my wife would tell you, if I got one of those calls, either as chief of staff or as county executive, that we had just, and I got down, we've had a homicide, I would say to her, it's awful, but I'm going to tell you what, within a week, we're going to have a press release saying we've caught, hats off to the men and women in the Baltimore County Police Department, because literally, by the end of the week, we almost always have them
And Don, I will say as a point of pride, we have some, you have some excellent detectives in Baltimore County, Detective Wolf, Detective Don Anderson. I worked with those guys, tremendous sergeants. We also have great detectives in Baltimore City, but if you're working twice as many homicides,
sure,
it's just harder to solve.
Absolutely. So. Well, now that segues us through to a topic that Nestor and I are very intrigued by, and it's this whole
issue. Can I throw one more thing in on murders?
Yeah.
Because I want to. This is probably a Lexington Market question, longer, you know, over than in one of these shorter segments. But when these murders happen, these 300 plus murders that happen with gang members, are they trying to hide it? You know what I'm saying? Like when. I've read up a lot on the Sean Suter thing and whatever happened there. I don't think we're ever going to know. I think there's some of that that disturbs me as a citizen. But some of these sort of random drive-by, something that happened over in Highland. First off, Eric Costello is on my Twitter, and there was a murder last night. There's a murder, you know, and whether it's in my district or not, but there's something happened over to Highland Town with a carjacking and a murder of a 40-year-old man over an area that I know to be a bit of Hispanic area up behind Highland Town where the old Santoni's was. That like 2 weeks ago. And it had like 5 a.m. and it was like 3 people in one. And I'm thinking to myself, you're just randomly, you know, basically thugging out to kill somebody. You're doing it on a street. Everyone has cameras and doorbell cameras. I'm thinking, like, how do you get away with a murder like that unless you've really orchestrated it to make sure they can't find you? It feels to me like it's not all that sophisticated when there's 300 a year, that it literally is, I'm on drugs, I got a gun, I'm mad, I'm going to go find them. Not anything that feels like a late night movie where there's been a whole lot of, you know, espionage and I'm going to cover my tracks. These are in many cases sloppy murders, are they not?
I'm actually, while you're doing this, I'm just pulling up some numbers that I gave in the conversation with Dan Rodericks. Murders in Baltimore, no doubt, are becoming more brazen. They are being committed during daytime hours, in public, with witnesses watching. The murder of that MTA bus driver.
That's all the more reason to think you should be caught. That if you're doing that.
100%.
Not to think that we sit around and think about murdering anybody, but I think if we did, we think about how we would not get caught. Like,
yeah, and let me give you some very concrete numbers, because these numbers were startling even to me. 42% of the murders that took place in Baltimore City over the past 4 years to happen during daytime hours, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., 42% of those murders. The exact numbers, 1,153 murders we have a time for, 500 of them happened during 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. So you think that, like, and 7 to 8 p.m. is actually a big hour as well. You think that they're happening at 11 p.m., 2 a.m. under cover of night. They're happening at 2 in the afternoon, 4 in the afternoon, right there on Edmondson Avenue, with traffic going in both directions. It's really, really terrible. But to your point, Nestor, if you think you can get away with murder, and you're right, because 8 out of 10 homicides are not resulting even in an arrest, then there's no reason to wait until night. There's no reason to wait until there's no witnesses. You can do it in plain sight and still have a nearly 80% chance of not even being arrested.
How is that possible? Witness intimidation? Witnesses don't see things that they say they don't see? Like, are we really at that point where people come out and murder people in broad daylight and no one wants to say I saw it?
I always put a pin in this theory that it's witness intimidation. That has been a factor for 20 years. That is a factor in Baltimore County. It's not like in Randallstown and Dundalk and Woodlawn, people are knocking on detectives' doors and saying, you know, Detective Wolf, I'd like to be a witness in your murder case. It's not happening in Baltimore City. It hasn't happened in Baltimore City for decades. We were solving cases because we had a good ratio of seasoned detectives to cases. They had resources, and we were using the forensic tools the prosecutors and police had to move towards ever since the stop snitching culture happened decades ago across America. We were using wiretaps. We were using undercover operations. We were using confidential informants. And yes, once in a while, you get a witness from the street to reinforce the rest of your case. But rarely is it one witness on the street who raises their hand, says, I'd like to testify in a murder case in Baltimore City. Sign me up. That never happens. It never has. That didn't happen in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. That started happening in the 80s and 90s.
Hey, Theroux, as you and Nestor expand on those ideas, I just had a thought. Are you suggesting that if Baltimore City, and this goes back to Nestor's idea of getting away with murder, that if the city were able to augment its homicide division and really begin to train and develop a new cadre, the next Gary Childs group, so to speak, these outstanding homicide detectives who do the work on the street, reduce their caseload, are you suggesting that that's one part of a crime strategy, that by solving existing murders, we actually help prevent new murders? Are you suggesting that?
Absolutely, and I'm suggesting it for two pretty obvious reasons. Number one, you send a deterrent to people to know that there is a real chance of getting caught if you commit a murder in Baltimore City. When I was a federal prosecutor, we would have informants, we would see this on the wire, where people would say, don't do that in the county, do it in the city. Because they knew that your chance of getting caught and prosecuted were higher under Jim Johnson and Scott Schellenberger than they were in Baltimore City, number one. Number two, we also know that a lot of these guys are repeat killers. They don't commit one murder and then go into retirement. They do it over and over again. So when you catch one of them, you are preventing murders of the future. Two very simple policy prescriptions. I obviously talked about this a lot on the campaign trail. Number one, literally, you should think about doubling the size of your homicide division. They could use 50 more homicide detectives. Now, you got to train them. You got to give them resources. You got to give them incentives to stay. That means potentially bringing officers out of retirement. It means taking officers that retired from Baltimore County and giving them incentives to come work in Baltimore City. It means promoting your local professional detectives from robberies and DDU, the district detective units, to homicide. And it also means creating a dedicated cold case unit. And this is just an interesting one to talk about. Baltimore City has the highest lethality rate in America. A couple years ago, we figured out that people were dying at a higher rate when they were shot in Baltimore City than virtually anywhere else in the country. And people said, why is that? We got Johns Hopkins on the east side. We got a level one shock trauma center on the west side. Why are our shootings more fatal? Well, it turns out we have a higher proportion of headshots than any American city. We have a higher average caliber weapon, and we have more casings per crime scene. So literally, Baltimore City killers are using bigger bullets, more bullets, and they're finishing their victims off with headshots. Now,
through. I know we're going to have to stop here soon. We're going to have you back real soon.
I'd like that.
We're going to have you back very, very soon. But please, I look at Nestor's face sometimes when you say those things, and it's like his head explodes. What are we talking about that we have more headshots, bigger guns, bigger bullets? What in the world does that mean?
Literally, the numbers are going up. So if you look at the average casings at crime scenes in Baltimore City, they're 40 calibers instead of 22 calibers. If you look at the number of casings at the crime scene, the average number of casings at the crime scene is higher in Baltimore City than anywhere else. And if you look at the percentage of fatal shootings, something like 50% of them are head wounds. That's higher than anywhere else. And what they do is they literally shoot them 10 times. And Justin George, reporter with the Baltimore Sun, documented this in a piece a couple years ago called Shoot to Kill. And he said people would literally shoot a person 5 or 10 times, then walk over, and even though they look dead, put two more bullets in their head to make sure. And what I have talked about is, like, that's a terrible statistic, but it does give you an opportunity, because it means the person who's doing that is not a first-time offender. This is somebody who's done it over and over and over again. If you got a cold case unit, dedicated 10, 15 detectives to that cold case unit, you can't solve every unsolved murder from last year. But go look at the homicides that have 40 caliber weapons, 10 or more casings at the crime scene, and 2 head wounds. You are looking at trained serial killers. You're looking at assassins. Work those cases. And if you solve that particular case, you're solving a murder that was committed by someone who likely did it many, many times before and would likely do it many, many more times in the future.
Theroux, we got to get on to really the reason we called you. Wasn't murders, but it's always here. You know, it's on the news. We're not arresting people with crimes now. You know, that comes to my door when I talk to local business owners and different people say, well, if they're going to commit crimes and not be arrested, back to your original point, you're going to commit murder and not be caught. Where are we and what's the reality of what's happening here?
Yeah, look, I have tried to really be positive about this. I mean, we need Brandon Scott, we need Michael Harrison, we need Marilyn Mosby to succeed. They are the first line of defense to violent crime. And, you know, a lot of folks have asked me about Marilyn's announcement that they're you know, putting into permanent position this policy of not prosecuting certain cases. Look, there's some measure of wisdom to this, right? We all know that in a case where there's carjacking, shootings, and homicides, you shouldn't be spending your police or prosecutorial resources, you know, going after people that are engaging in trespass or loitering. My concern is, I think that happened a long time ago. We stopped prosecuting loitering and trespass cases a while ago. Sometimes you still have to make the arrest, right? If somebody is engaging in, you know, public urination or carrying an open container or prostitution right in front of a police officer, you can't ask the police officer to literally just turn the other way and drive in the other direction. That's not a responsible way of setting it up. But of course, we have to triage our resources. I think the challenge is that Marilyn Mosby has made an announcement without really coordinating it with the police department. You're hearing literally in news coming out today that we're starting to look at a diversion program in the 911 system. So when you call for certain offenses, that can be diverted to a different set of resources than cops. That's the kind of thing that probably should be put in place before you make that announcement. I also don't know that you need to make that announcement. If you choose not to prosecute a guy for loitering in your discretion, fine. If the police department wants to adopt a policy that they're not going to arrest people for open container, just like they don't arrest people for jaywalking anymore, just do it. You don't need to have a big announcement that advertises to the world that we're not arresting people for prostitution anymore. I just saw an article in the Washington Post. It made Baltimore look very bad. They were talking about residents walking down the street. There's a woman who was walking her dog and was being solicited. You know, she sees a guy having sex in the back of a car at 4 p.m. That is not the image that I want the Washington Post to portray of Baltimore to the world. And that's all happening because we're advertising a policy. There is some wisdom to focusing your resources on a certain class of cases. I don't know that calling press conferences and you know, presenting that as a big a weapon in the war against, you know, calling for criminal justice reform is the way that we should be doing it.
Well, Theroux, as I said, whenever we have you on, the segments are far too short. I want to have you back on so we can expand on this. And when we come back for another episode in the near future, I really want to talk about which specific crimes are on that list, because I'm really curious about the difference between drug distribution and felony distribution, those things that you can help walk us through. And then we want to talk some Maryland politics when we come back. So I hope you'll come back in the very near future.
I would like that a lot. I always enjoy these conversations, and they're always too short. Let's grab a drink at Fadley's very soon.
We're going to have a crab cake tour coming up this summer, and you're invited. So, hey, I see that Oriole hat. You set your Zoom up all wrong, man. You put the Oriole hat behind you. I can't even see it. Now you look like you had a little Orioles magic there.
I'm very excited. Some early signs of promise. So
there you go.
Oh, come on.
There you go. You and me, Theroux.
Come on.
You
now.
And me,
we're Baltimore
Theroux.
Positive, but we're not
Hope
Baltimore foolish.
Springs
come on now.
Eternal.
Oriole
Hope
magic.
Springs
make
eternal.
It happen.
See you later, Theroux. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Taos in Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore positive.